I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March 25th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Johansson is present. Wasliwick.
Wasliwick present.
Einteman.
Present.
Acone.
She's on her way.
Acklin.
Acklin present.
Backer.
Backer present.
Becker Finn.
Present.
Eklund.
Present.
Fisher.
Fisher present.
Green.
Present.
Igo.
Igo present.
Jordan.
Present.
Keeler.
Present.
Lee.
Lee present.
Lippert.
Lippert present.
Lewick.
Lewick present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Nelson.
Nelson present.
Tice. Tice. Representative Tice, you popped up, but I think you might have had a little trouble hearing you there. Quorum is present.
You're muted, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you're muted.
Yep. The minutes are a quorum is present. The next item on the agenda are the minutes for Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. Representative Heinzman, have you reviewed the minutes?
I did, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes.
Representative Heinzman moves the minutes for March 23rd, 2021. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, the minutes are approved. Members, we have four bills today. The first is House File 1505 by Representative Sandsteed, Forestry and Bioeconomy Applied Research Funding. Welcome to the committee, Representative Sandsteed.
Good afternoon, Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Would you like to have one of your members move the bill before the committee?
I will move that House File 1505 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. We have allotted about 10 minutes for this, Representative Sandsteed, to your bill.
Perfect. Thank you so very much. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1505 would invest $2 million in the MnDRIVE program at the University of Minnesota Duluth's Natural Resource Research Institute to develop and demonstrate a pair of technologies that enhance the long-term health and management of Minnesota's forest resources, industries, and accelerate emerging opportunities. The first project is at a cost of $500,000, and it would continue development of a forest management asset and decision tool that integrates forest productivity, ecosystem services, and economic information to identify the benefits and trade-offs of land management decisions. The tool would monitor 17 million acres of forest. The second project in this bill, for which NRI is seeking $1.5 million, would help them develop and demonstrate biochar opportunities. Biochar is produced from biomass waste residues, customized for beneficial uses, and to create new forestry and manufacturing jobs. This funding would go to the lab to pilot demonstration, operation cost assistance, and infrastructure and facility upgrades. I want to make a quick mention that in 2019, the legislature invested money in getting these projects started. This appropriation, if approved and included, would get these projects across the finish line. With me today is Don Fosnacht from NRRI.
Welcome, Dr. Fosnacht. If you could introduce yourself and who you're with for the record.
Yes, I'm Donald Fosnacht. I'm an associate director of the Institute, and I'm representing our executive director, Ralph Weberg, who unfortunately could not be here because of a personal matter today. So thank you for your introduction, Representative Sandstead, and thank you, Chair Hansen, and the committee members for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 1505 and 06. NRI greatly values the partnership with the Minnesota State Legislature over the past 6 years to identify natural resource challenges, focus applied research efforts, and deliver results and opportunity for Minnesota. We take this responsibility very seriously and have held ourselves accountable to you with regular reports, updates, and occasional on-site tours. In fact, once this COVID situation has been resolved, we'd like to invite you to come up to both our Duluth and Coleraine facilities to see some of the things that we have done. As part of the University of Minnesota Research Enterprise, NRI occupies a nationally unique, non-academic role of applied research and natural resources. We do not work alone. We collaborate and partner broadly across not only the university system, but also with other institutions, agencies, industries, businesses, entrepreneurs, NGOs, and state citizens. We are a mission-driven, outcome-oriented, multidisciplinary research organization for Minnesota, all under one roof. We were established by the legislature in 1983 to focus on economic development, job creation, while maintaining a key focus on the environment. NRI provides a strong return on the state's investment. I am pleased to present three quick examples and others during my comments that support this. NRI was open on March 18th, 3 days after the state COVID shutdown, to help our critical industries, state and federal agencies, and local governments. One of the things we did, for example, was making parts for the health community using our prototyping lab. Some of these were involved with the pneumatic system to keep a positive pressure while people were working. NRI also received $240,000 from the legislature in 2019 to initiate geometallurgic review of the remaining Biwabik Iron Formation. And last month, due to this effort, we leveraged into winning a competitive $2.6 million grant to support capital investment in pyrometallurgical equipment to assist the iron industry in making value-added metallic iron products from Minnesota ore. NRI received $800,000 from the legislature in 2019 to extend the Natural Resources Atlas to statewide coverage. Well, it will be completed this coming fall. Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources shared that they and other many municipalities across the state are learning to depend upon this novel tool for planning and decision-making. External estimates to create such a tool range from $7 to $12 million, and our NRI has delivered this tool on time and on budget at $1.3 million. This biennium, we are engaging with the legislature with a limited, focused request, but a request critical to sustaining efforts to develop our next generation of natural resource economies. We strongly believe the project that we're asking you to support represent crucial steps toward this goal. This request is separate from the University of Minnesota Board of Regents request, which is under consideration by the Higher Ed Committee. Again, we do not do this work alone. The funds we receive do support NRI activities, but they also go beyond the Institute to include collaborators across the university system and partners within our state institutions, agencies, businesses, and industries. In fact, about 2 weeks ago, we met with a pellet company to see how we could help with some of their residuals. At this time, I'd like to share basically,
we have about a minute left, Dr. Faustin. About a minute left. Go ahead. Okay.
What I'd like to do is just go over the essence of the bills.
Go ahead.
Okay.
And is this both bills you're going over, or just
this will be 1505. I'm just going to talk off the actual cover that we had sent.
Proceed.
Okay. Just want to share the screen. 1505. Okay, this one basically has already been mentioned. We want to extend the use of the forest management assessment tool basically from 4 million acres that is currently covered to over 17.4 million acres and go from 300,000 parcels up to 1.6 million parcels. This has already been used greatly in the area that is already covered, and we think that this will allow forest management and ecosystem management to be done in a systematic way by having a tool where they can look at various aspects associated with choosing the required practices to maintain the environment while actually utilizing the resources that we have. So this is an expansion greatly beyond what we already have done. And so this first project basically is building on that previous work, as Representative Sandstedt has already mentioned.
Okay, Dr. Fostad, we actually have that in our packets. So we've read it. It's posted, so it's available. Are there any questions from members for Dr. Fostad? Representative Lippert.
I'll just make a quick comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Sandstedt for her work on this and Dr. Fosnick for the presentation. There's just think there's tremendous potential for biochar as a soil amendment and in helping soil sequester carbon, and thinking about black ash to biochar, I think has great potential for our state too. So just want to thank you for the work.
You're welcome. I think we can take the biochar a long way. There's a bunch of industrial as well as agricultural applications, and we think we can use residuals as well as beetle-type trees, things of that nature, and convert that to a useful product with what we're proposing.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sandstedt. This is really an important area. For example, just in one of the counties I represent, we've got a 500,000 acres of public land, county and state, that's forest, and it takes a lot of time and effort to keep track of that. And any tools that we can use to reduce the cost of managing those forests. The other one that's really important, we've got a number of wood processing plants throughout Northeast Minnesota, and one of the issues we end up with is residue that we have to deal with, sawdust and you name it, and that becomes a potential hazard. You know, what do you do with it? And so this is an avenue to continue to use every bit of that forest product and not end up having to dump it someplace and hope the environment can take care of it. So this is important stuff. Thank you.
Representative Lewick, we really support what you just said. We also think that conversion to some chars can also lead to some energy-related benefits at an individual who might have that, for example, to do a co-power generation at the facility.
Yeah. Representative Sandstedt, I have a question. Dr. Fostad had mentioned that this was not part of the university package, and so how do we as a committee reconcile a university request that's not in higher ed?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. When the original proposals were presented in 2019, and these are based on economy, environmental solutions. Back in 2019, these bills were put into the Environmental Finance Committee. And as such, that's how we're seeing it here. They are, I would say, an offshoot of the university. They have their base operations maintenance funding coming from the university, but much of the work that they have to do has to be leveraged from other sources, such as the legislature, federal dollars, and other sources. So I hope that answered your question.
Just Representative Sandstedt, trying to remember, I think that the funding came through LCCMR at the end. Is that correct?
I believe you are correct on that. But the hearings itself, the original course or the path of the bills was run through the environmental committees.
Any closing remarks on this bill?
I would just appreciate your support.
I will renew my motion that House File 1505 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. House File 1506, Representative Sandsteed, State Mineral and Water Resources Funding Provided and Money Appropriated. I will move that House File 1506 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Sandsteed, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1506 is a $2 million appropriation to the MnDRIVE program at the Natural Resource Research Institute to develop and demonstrate technologies that enhance the long-term health and management of Minnesota's minerals and water resources. The legislation proposed here today funds two different projects. First, the $600,000 would go towards the demonstration of three different sulfate reduction technology applications to help prevent contamination of water bodies across the state. The money would go toward designing, building, and commissioning a mobile biological treatment unit, a multi-site deployment for data collection and analysis, and partner outreach. The second program would use $1.4 million investment to research Minnesota's future iron resources, next generation technologies, and new iron products. As higher quality ores are becoming depleted, but abundant lower quality ores are remaining abundant, we must begin investing today to ensure we have an iron industry of the future. This will require developing new technologies and high value iron products while addressing sustainable development goals associated with impact reductions in carbon and other emissions, water utilization, and energy consumption. And for the members on both of these bills, as I have said before, I truly believe NRRI to have solutions that the entire state is facing. You've heard some of the talk in the forestry component. This one is focusing on water issues and iron economies potentially of the future. Right now, I know throughout the state, we have water issues in the northeastern part of the state, as well as in southern Minnesota, with sulfates, nitrates, PFAS. So the issues are statewide, and I believe investments in these two bills are really solutions that also will reach statewide. On the Iron Range, where I come from, we have a great deal of rock waste, mining waste, that is just sitting there. But really, there is a huge potential of not having to do new mining, but to use what is already there for high-value products into the future. So again, I would stand for questions. I also have Don Fosnacht here to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions? Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Sandstead. Obviously, the NRRI is a great organization, and I'm happy to have one of their facilities right in my district there in Coleraine. You know, just reading through this, this is great. I just wonder, with the $1.4 million that's a part of HF 1506 here, is there any reason to include potential like non-ferrous in there? Just because I know that they do a lot of research, too, with what, you know, the Iron Range is eventually going to become the Copper Range, right? So is there any way that that should be instituted in this language, or is that going to be another bill, or that's just my question.
Representative Sandsteed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Igo, I'm actually going to push that one to Mr. Fosnacht. I'm not really sure about what type of future industries there is around, or how they would be addressing that future industry. So to Mr. Fosnacht.
Dr. Posnett. Yes,
A couple of critical things we see with the iron site first. When I joined the Institute about 20 years ago, we had 38 blast furnaces that were existing in the U.S. We're down to 17 today, and the electric arc furnace industry basically was 40% of the total steel make in the U.S. at that time. Now it's 70%. So we're trying to develop the technologies that will keep the iron ore industry viable for the long term, and we need to have specific monies to help modernize some of the plants along the lines that Representative Sandstead has already mentioned. Plus, we've been approach by various parties to look at other uses of iron. And that includes a large battery development for energy storage using metallic iron, as well as various iron components that go into water cleaning. So we're looking at expanding the uses of iron with this particular focus. But we also have not neglected to look at the non-ferrous side, and we're trying to take advantage of what we have with some existing fundings to start the work that may be needed in there as that particular industry starts to develop. So we're focused on what we think is a critical factor for the iron industry, in that their current base of customers is declining, and we need to come up with other solutions that will keep them viable long term, including the shipping that occurs over the Great Lakes system. So we know what to do to get them virgin iron for this electric arc sector, and actually the DOE project that we also have recently obtained is focused on trying to take some of the materials we currently use and make them amenable for that type of use.
Representative Igo, follow up.
Thank you. You know, that was a fantastic answer, and thanks for kind of diving into that for me. You know, I really do think, like I said, this is a great bill that you guys do great work there. I know about it. And it was great that you Representative Sanchez, you mentioned the tailings waste, right? And that's on my side of the district, the West Range, right? And I think for the committee here and those listening, it's super interesting to know that all of those piles actually have iron content that is kept and monitored by the DNR. So that organizations like NRRI can come in and say, hey, there's 16% iron in this pile. Here's how we can come in and extract it and keep our iron industry alive in northeastern Minnesota. So thank you for doing what you do, and thank you again, Representative Sandsteed.
And Representative Eagle, just a quick comment. There's
Doctor. I'm sorry, but no. I'm sorry. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering where additional funding for NRI comes from. It seems like a lot of the projects that are referenced would be really beneficial to certain corporate businesses and different industries, and just wondering where other funding comes from for this work.
Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Becker-Finn. I am not going to be able to provide you a comprehensive list. Maybe Dr. Fosnock could help with that. I do know that with the monies that the state invested in 2019, they were able to leverage federal dollars. Some money has come from the Department of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, but not at all for any kind of research. They don't fund that. And maybe Dr. Fosnock can provide other sources.
Dr. Fosnott, to the question.
Chair Nelson, or Hanson, excuse me, we do have some funding from the state special that the legislature provides. We also have some funding that's dedicated to the mineral side and also water related to minerals from the Permian City Trust Fund. We probably are funded at about a 40% level overall from those types of funding, and the rest of it we have to seek from other sources. So whether it's federal grants, state grants, industrial clients, we look to have a complete portfolio of funding from a variety of sources.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that sounded like a lot of different taxpayer funds going from different pots of money, and I just really want to emphasize that, you know, if this is the kind of thing that's benefiting you know, corporate interests, that it would be great if they could be a bigger part of funding this kind of thing, and not necessarily you know, our general fund that can be used for a lot of different things. So just wanted to find that out. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I'm not convinced that this is benefiting corporate at all. This is benefiting everyday citizens across the state of Minnesota. And as the legislature, you know, we hear from different groups continuously on how do we solve this problem. And as I stated earlier, I truly believe that they are the solution to so many of the environmental and economic issues that our state is facing. They have that potential. As Dr. Fosnock stated, really, they do not receive enough base funding to do the work that they are doing. They are scrapping on a skeletal crew all the time to do this transformational work. So any investment that the legislature can make is greatly appreciated. And as legislators, we are tasked with allocating a limited number of dollars to programs that provide the highest or yield the highest return. And I would not come before this committee if I did not believe that those dollars are going to yield that kind of return that we're looking for.
I was going to ask you for closing comments, but I think you just did a great job there. So
thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 1506 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I want to see if Representative Marquardt is here. I know he is double booked in some other committees, so it appears he is not. So, Vice Chair Wozlawick, would you like to take the gavel?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will do that. Next on the agenda is House File 1877, Critical Habitat Private Sector Matching Account Use Modified and Money Appropriated. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1877 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Hansen, I believe you also have an author's amendment. Will you move the A2 amendment so we can get it before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move the A2 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, to the bill as amended. You know, we've previously had some discussion about the critical habitat license plates. They are very popular in Minnesota, established over two decades ago. If you look in the information provided to the committee, you will see we have a proliferation of license plates in general. And then there is a proliferation of the critical habitat plates. I don't know if it's possible to share that screen, but I think it was in the document. With the amendment, what we did is we took the critical habitat bill that was in 1877. We clarified on which plates would go to which funds. So primarily we are having the loon and the lady slipper and the chickadee would go to the non-game programs. In addition, there currently is a cap of $7,000 on promoting the critical habitat plates. So we increase the allowable use up to $25,000 per year for to help promote the plates. We allow that there would be monitoring of those sites that are paid for with critical habitat plates. So after 25 years, we think this is a good modernization. Provides for more accurate expense for those habitat plates. We also separate out the angler plate so that that would go to aquatic management activities. And I think this is a clearer appropriation of funds. The most recent plate that was adopted was the pollinator plate. And that plate was adopted by the DNR. We take the funds from that plate and dedicate them to the Lawns to Legumes program. The Lawns to Legumes program has been extremely popular. Appropriation was provided one time from the LCCMR, and the demand has been great. I believe that Representative Morrison has an amendment relating to that.
Representative Morrison does have the A1 amendment. Representative Morrison, do you want to move the A1 amendment? And I think Representative Hansen gave a description, but if you want to just clarify that for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment, which would appropriate general fund dollars to Bowser to continue the Lawns to Legumes program.
Representative Morrison moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say nay. The amendment is adopted. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, did you have anything else or did you want to move to testifiers?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to testifiers. We have from DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources that can help describe the programs.
All right. First up on the list, I have Commissioner Bob Meyer. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, if you want to identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for allowing us to be able to testify on this bill. As you know, the governor's budget contains language that would allow us to expedite these dollars onto get them onto the ground for conservation. We have also been working with the conservation community very closely on adapting that proposal to fit the needs of what we see and to meet the intent of the existing program, the current program. The language in the amendment, though much better, still presents some concerns to the DNR. By bifurcating the plates by design into either acquisition or non-game or the lawn sollegium program, we create winners and losers rather than work through the entire account as is intended in statute. By taking the big game turkey or pheasant license plates and requiring them to be used on acquisition and monitoring, we appreciate the inclusion of inventory and monitoring because Ann Pierce will talk about how important that is. It creates winners and losers, and it reduces the funding available for acquisition while increasing the non-game funding, which is what our intentions are as well. And we just our current proposal does not increase the non-game spending by as much as this proposal would do. The amendment also removes language in the current statute that allows for improvements of lands. Our proposal will change that word improvement to restorations or enhancements. So now, rather than allowing acquisition, restoration, and enhancement to occur out of these funds, you're just allowing acquisition, inventory, and monitoring to be used out of the acquisition dollars. In addition, by bifurcating these plates by design, it will further increase the problem that we're having on spending these dollars, as it will be difficult to find sometimes an aquatic management area that would meet the needs of the program and fit within the funding that we have. So again, creating winners and losers. Also, by taking the pollinator plate, which was recently established, and dedicating those funds to the residential landscaping projects that provide pollinator habitat, there's no match on that either. And we're concerned about what that growth will do of the pollinator plate as somebody will switch from a loon or a chickadee or a lady slipper to the pollinator plate, what that impact will be to the non-game program. I think it's also important to note that the non-game program is almost entirely funded by the critical habitat plate program, which matches the chickadee checkoff program, which actually the picture on your tax forms is a loon, not a chickadee for the chickadee checkoff. So in closing, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, we do appreciate the effort that's being placed on how to update this program. We are concerned on some of the changes that are presented and some of the potential long-term impacts that may be there for the non-game program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, next up, I do have Ann Pierce from the DNR. I don't know, Ms. Pierce, if you have anything that you wanted to add here.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and committee members. I'll just add really briefly to think about the kind of work that we're doing with the money we get from these license plates, especially for the non-game program. Right now, we have some limits on how we can spend that money. And one of the things we are looking at is broadening what we can spend it on from non-game to other rare resources and native plant community monitoring. And the reason for that is because if we, in today's day and age with climate change and invasive species, really want our best conservation outcomes, we need to be able to conserve and manage wildlife and plants together. And just a really brief example of that would be if we have pollinators on our landscape, those pollinators are dependent often on pollinator plants, and in some cases, very specific plants. And we're doing lots of restoration for our pollinators on our landscape, but we're really not clear as to if those restoration outcomes are serving the pollinators that we think they are. We don't know that we are burning at the right time. We don't know that we're producing the plants that they need for nectar, for overwintering, and a variety of different things. And if we can use this money in an integrated way, that will be much more effective at actually conserving the wildlife and the habitat that we're trying to conserve with these dollars currently. Thank you.
All right, we are gonna move to member discussion. We do have Dave Wierens here from Bowser, if folks have questions for them. But let's move to member questions. First up, I have Representative Becker-Finn and then Representative Wulick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank Chair Hansen for bringing this forward. I think, you know, the issue isn't so much what an agency or even legislators have intended or assumed about the funds, but I think the general public certainly thinks that when they're buying a pollinator plate, that's going directly to help pollinators, or when they buy a certain plate, you know. And I think, you know, we may have made it more complicated by offering more options for folks, but if that's overall bringing in more funds because more people are choosing these plates, I don't think that's a bad thing. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think that's an important piece of this discussion, is sort of what the general public assumes and what they think they're doing when they're paying these extra dollars for these special plates. So thank you, Chair Hansen, for bringing this forward.
Representative Lewick, you're up next, and then Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess there's a good elements in this bill, particularly adjusting that match for the donated funds. We've got an issue there, and projects and programs are being held back by problem there. So that makes sense to fix that. I'm very concerned, though, that we're now going to start taking money out of this fund and sliding it over to Bowser. Got nothing against Bowser, but as I understand it, those dollars will all go to private property and backyards. So how's the general public? Certainly we want to protect our pollinators, but I think we're moving way, way too far afield here on the base reason that we've got this program. So I would ask the author to consider matching the governor's efforts here, but I would like to see us just let lie this, starting to parse this thing up by individual picture on a license plate, because I think I would predict that that's going to touch off a lot of tension and unnecessary competition and ultimately hard feelings. Because it takes away the discretion of the Department of Natural Resources to move in areas that needed to be moved in. So again, I don't see a problem here with trying to split this up and basically pick winners and losers. So I'd ask you to hang on to the ratio changes, that type of stuff, but really leave lie this starting to parse it up by pictures on a license plate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen, did you want to reply?
Thank you, Vice Chair. Well, I think it's time for non-game wildlife to be the winners. It's important, and I find it somewhat ironic to be supporting competition and the market determining where the investments are. The pollinator plate was only created a few months ago. So whatever intent was established 25 years ago, the DNR created the plate, the pollinator plate, and it's perfectly appropriate for the legislature to engage into where those funds should go. There is a high demand for the pollinator plate. There is a high demand for lawns to legumes. And with the Morrison Amendment, we're providing a couple tracks to provide consistent funding, a couple of options for consistent funding for those Minnesotans who want to implement pollinator practices on their lawns, their property, which may be in the city, and that city could be wherever in the state, small towns throughout the state, neighbors have got together to implement lawns to legumes. And the science shows that even a little bit of habitat, which is matched, lawns to legumes is matched by the homeowner, even a little bit of habitat can be very important for species like the rusty patch bumblebee, which is endangered and is our state bee. So I think this is a good bill. We've taken some of the input that we've been hearing, tried to adjust that. We've heard the governor's bill. We'll continue to work on some of the language as this bill is going to be laid over.
Representative Lewick, did you have a follow-up?
Again, since that, you know, you're speaking about a program that was very recently created, do you already have specific issues with what the DNR is going to do with that future revenue? I mean, you really have a conflict with what the commissioner intends to do there. I mean, I'm, you know, you talk about, yeah, recently. I mean, how many dollars are there now? And obviously, we hope there's plenty in the future. But do you really have a gut problem with what the DNR may do in the future with this, that we have to go in and say it's got to be this way or no way?
Chair Hansen.
Representative Woslawick, Representative Lewick, you may remember 2 years ago we discussed that there's $24 million that has accumulated in the Critical Habitat Fund. 2 years ago, I tried to provide an incentive on conservation reserve land to get some of that money into habitat, and that was opposed. $24 million sitting there in the Critical Habitat Fund. And as we add a very popular plate, I think it's perfectly reasonable to dedicate that to pollinator activities. I have had constituents who have been surprised that it goes to the general RIM program versus specific pollinator habitat. I will acknowledge that RIM habitat, because we changed the law back in 2013, that state lands need to have pollinator habitat. There's a multiple use and multiple reasons for that. But with that pollinator plate, that's something that could be dedicated, particularly when there's $24 million sitting there in the Critical Habitat Fund.
Representative Lewick?
Well, I do agree that we shouldn't have that kind of money sitting there, and that goes back to fundamentally, maybe we need to take a look at putting some floors or some caps in there on how much of that does not have to be spent with a private sector match, because it would go right back to basics again. Now we're going to go out and fund areas on non-public land, on private property, without a long-term easement type approach, 2 or 3 years, and they can bail out of the lawn to legumes program with no fault. I just think there's a better way to approach this. So anyway, thank you, Madam Chair and bill author.
All right, next up, I have Representative Heitzman.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions and some comments as well. I'm going to start just by, I hope, benefiting the public to some extent by pointing out that the pollinator plate is part of the Critical Habitat Program, and it was promoted to protect and purchase permanent habitat. So this idea that bumblebee money was going to just some kind of random here and there out of that realm project is, I think, a little bit disingenuous. I think that we need to recognize that. And then, you know, as we're talking about lawns to legumes in this bill, you know, I think that people need to understand we're not talking about some kind of special environment natural resources revenue account in this amendment from Representative Morrison, but we're talking about taking money right out of the general fund again to work on somebody's lawn, and the match can be up to 25% of an individual's labor. So if we're not talking dollar for dollar here, we're literally paying $1 million out of the general fund to help somebody put in flowers in place of their lawn. Now, in some situations, maybe that makes great sense, but we're talking about general fund dollars in that amendment. You know, I'm thinking that between the many, 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 many programs, and Rick and I, we go back and forth on this, Representative Hansen, I see you smiling, and it's just something that I think the public needs to understand as we're talking about this program. I do have a question for Representative Hansen and for Bowser, though. And I'm curious if Bowser could let me know, how long do the landscaping projects that are being proposed in this have to be maintained? I'm curious if it's a one and done, or what's the ongoing responsibility?
Mr. Wierens, if you want to just introduce yourself for the record and answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Wierens, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The time period for the grants is consistent with how we do our cost share most typically, is that there is a 10-year expectation that they'll maintain that practice on their lawn.
Representative Heintzman, did you have a follow-up question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the answer. Thank you for that. And then for Representative Hansen, I am wondering, you know, we're making quite a departure from how these plates and the revenues would have previously been funded. I am glad that, and this is something I like about your bill today, is, you know, we're making it easier to spend some of those revenues for $2 million just to sit there unspent and unused. You know, that's not productive. I think that, you know, we want to make sure that the dollars go where they're going to be useful. But I am curious, I didn't see a breakdown of what kind of expectation we might have in those categories. I'm assuming you have some kind of an estimate.
Chair Hansen?
Madam Chair and Representative Heintzman, I think if you look in the committee information, it has the breakdown of how many plates are sold by each, so you can see the volume. And obviously, you have the replacement of the plates over time, stickers that go on, but when those plates are renewed, you have the dollars that come in. So you see, you can see what the market is showing on those. I think the loon is probably the most popular. And I think that data is from 2019, so the bumblebee, or the rusty patch bumblebee one is not on there yet. I know that they are prominently, I was just in my deputy registrar yesterday, and I know that they are very prominent in there, and people like those plates. You know, you can tell you're in Minnesota when we're debating what we should spend with a chickadee checkoff or bumblebee bucks. It's a resource-based discussion, and we are going to have disagreements. The idea here with Representative Morrison's addition is we need long-term funding. I believe that the LCCMR appropriation was about 900,000. There have been over 3 million in requests that have come in. And during COVID, this is something that people have been doing in their yard without the money. The ability to get the technical assistance and make those changes is happening all over the state. And neighbors are working together to implement this. The rusty patch bumblebee is iconic now in Minnesota, and people want to protect it. And so this is with this new plate that wasn't envisioned 25 years ago, was envisioned maybe 25 months ago, is now something that can be dedicated toward that. And providing consistent funding would help Minnesotans implement these practices to protect the resource that we all enjoy.
Representative
Heintzman,
do you follow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was, I think that we almost got to an answer there. Thank you, Representative Hansen. But, you know, there's not a handout there, unfortunately, for everybody, unless they are looking for it. So that's why I asked if you had those numbers in front of you. And maybe we could get to that at some point in the discussion around this bill. But I'm going to move on to another question. I am wondering, you know, because typically when we hear a bill like this, we see conservation groups lined up to testify, and I haven't seen any of those today. So I am wondering, number one, where are the conservation groups at on this? And then also I'm wondering, maybe DNR could come back and give us an idea how much has been spent to promote the private match to the critical habitat program. With making the adjustment that we are in the ratio required to release those dollars. I am wondering if that's been promoted well, or if there's more that we could do there to make sure that if there are people that want to participate and contribute, that they know their dollars are going further than they otherwise would.
Chair Hansen, do you want to take up that first question?
Thank you, Chair Wislawa. The first part, I think there was some comment on the original bill, and then the amendment was posted 24 hours ago. I have not received anything formal from groups. I've received a couple Facebook messages, thumbs up from individuals who had looked at the amendment. So I think they're probably digesting it as the committee is.
And I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Meyer or Ms. Pierce from DNR could help with the second question.
Madam Chair, I can answer that for
Assistant
us.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Chairman Hansen was correct in saying that previously we were limited to, I believe, about $7,000. I think it was actually $13,000 for promotion. So this would help us tremendously. To date, a lot of that promotional activities has been with the deputy registrars and dealers as people are buying new motor vehicles. But I think there is a lot more to be done out there for sure to promote that. And just if I may quickly talk about the balance in the account. The account has an actual balance of license plate revenues of $16 million. There's $8 million of private donations that are there that we're working to spend down. One of the challenges we see is when someone donates money to the program, they donate it to a specific type of habitat, say wetland acquisition in Aiken County. Well, we all know Aiken County has a ton of wetland, so it's really challenging for us to try to find land of certain types that people want us to do it. So it builds up that dollars. Currently, we're taking in about $5 million a year from the plates. We get about $3 million in match a year. So it's building up at $2 million a year. Now expanding it to 2-to-1 will help us buy that down. But once that 2-to-1 match is there, I'm concerned about the impacts to the non-game program. As people shift from a loon plate to a pollinator plate, for example, that will take money from the non-game program, send it to Bowser. So, Madam Chair, thank you so much.
And I see Mr. Wirens has his hand up. Did you want to chime in on this one?
No, Madam Chair. I just kind of wanted to correct my prior answer to Representative Heisman's question. The correct answer is actually 5 years. I went to verify my answer, and the expectation from the landowner is a minimum of 5 years when they receive funds under Lawns and Legumes program. So I apologize for the prior error in my answer.
Thank you. Representative Heisman, did you have further questions?
I think that we've covered some of the difficulties with the bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next up, I see Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just really want to put a finer point on what I think Chair Hansen is saying, is that when, my neighbors and I, mostly my neighbors, planted on our condo, we had, a lot of lawn space, and they had heard about the Lawns to Legumes program and realized that we could grow pollinator-friendly plants on our shared lawn and use our condo dollars for that instead of on maintaining our lawn. And I think, and then my neighbors very proudly showed me their new pollinator plate and said they hoped it was going, they were so excited to be able to help the bees, some of that bumblebee money that everyone has had so much fun saying. But so I really do think people think that that money is going, when they buy a plate with a bumblebee on it, they think it's explicitly going to help bumblebees and native pollinators. And so there's much as we can talk about where this money is going, that's not what the public is saying. And I think by having this committee and talking about the difficulties of this, we're really showing why this program is needed. So people are also transferring their money where they maybe had a chickadee plate, and then now they're deciding that they want to instead have a bumblebee plate. I think they're really demonstrating that that's what they want that extra money to be used for. So I think this is a really great program that a lot of Minnesotans will like. And I think this is a good amendment that we've been working on to make sure that people really are getting what they think that they're buying and what they're really proud to have. I mean, these are beautiful plates and Minnesotans are really lucky that they can take advantage of it. So I think this is a really great bill, and I think this is something that our constituents and that the public would really like to see us take advantage of. So thank you for doing this, Chair Hansen.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to remind folks about why the Lawns to Legumes program was created in the first place. It was created in response to drastic decline in pollinator populations in general and the rusty patch bumblebees specifically. And research has shown that urban and suburban areas can play an important role in pollinator preservation and resurrection. So the Lawns to Legumes program is not about helping people plant pretty gardens, although that can be a happy side effect of it. It's about protecting our pollinator populations, which are in dangerous decline.
Any other member questions or comments? I don't see any hands going up, so we'll go to Chair Hansen for any closing remarks.
Members, I think this has been a good discussion. It's an open discussion that hasn't been held in a long time. I think this is a good compromise bill, and I look forward to continuing that discussion and to protect the resource. I would renew my motion that House File 1877, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1877, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over, and I will turn the gavel back over to Chair Hansen.
Is Representative Marquardt here?
Mr. Chair, I've been texting with Representative Marquardt, and he's tied up in the Taxes Committee. But maybe we want to just start with the testifiers, or
why don't we have someone move the bill? Vice Chair Wozlawick, do you want to just move the bill for Representative Marquardt?
Yep, I can move. I'll move that House File 1014 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
House File 1014 by Representative Marquardt, Representative Wozlawick moves it 1014 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Marquardt has three testifiers, and I will invite them to speak to the bill. Jeremy Greenhouse, American Crystal Sugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might, I would like to have Crystal Sugar's Environmental Affairs Manager, Doug Emerson, speak first. And if possible, I'd like to share my screen for just a couple slides we have.
Mr. Emerson, and if each of the testifiers could state their name and who they're with for the record before they speak. Mr. Emerson, welcome.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Doug Emerson. I'm the Environmental Affairs Manager with American Crystal Sugar Company.
Welcome.
I guess I appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of the committee members here today regarding House File 1014. Our company supports this bill because it would eliminate a double standard being applied within the state of Minnesota regarding the requirements that businesses who discharge wastewater must meet for whole effluent toxicity, or WET. This double standard has a significant impact on the 2,600 grower owners of American Crystal Sugar Company. If our factories were located within the Lake Superior Basin region of Minnesota, the MPCA's rules would allow a WET mixing zone, and implementing this mixing zone would cost less than $1 million. However, because we are located outside of the Lake Superior Basin, the same rules do not apply, and the MPCA has a policy prohibiting WET mixing zones. As a result, to meet the WET requirements, we would need to build a treatment facility that would cost $14 million. American Crystal Sugar believes the requirements should be the same across the state. Before any of American Crystal Sugar Company's facilities can discharge final treated wastewater into a nearby river, certain permit conditions must be met. American Crystal Sugar has been working in good faith with the MPCA for over a decade now to find ways to address toxicity. One of the most cost-effective solutions includes the establishment of what is known as an acute WET mixing zone. A mixing zone allows a less stringent permit limit as long as applicable water quality is met after mixing. The MPCA's rules in the Lake Superior Basin allow a limited mixing zone for WET. Thus, Crystal Sugar's proposed solution for toxicity Crystal Sugar's proposed solution for toxicity factored in the wet mixing zone allowed under MPCA's Lake Superior Basin rules. It is important to emphasize that this approach is not only allowed by the MPCA in the Lake Superior Basin, it is also recommended by the EPA to protect aquatic life and allowed by other states, including North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Missouri. This mixing zone approach addressed by this bill, when combined with a diffuser and a properly designed mixing zone, will provide more overall downstream protection of aquatic life than if we continue to use the approach that the MPCA is requiring today. Today's approach is the single pipe only option without mixing. Unfortunately, the MPCA has denied American Crystal Sugar's approach, saying the agency has a policy of not allowing acute wet mixing zone in areas outside of Minnesota's Lake Superior Basin. American Crystal Sugar Company supports this bill and urges the committee to move the bill because it would ensure businesses in all parts of Minnesota are afforded the same protective rules pertaining to whole effluent toxicity. Now I'd like to turn it over to Jeremy Greenhouse. He is our American Crystal Sugar Company's environmental legal counsel, and he would be explaining a couple of regulatory aspects of this bill.
Thank you. Thank
you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeremy Greenhouse, and I am outside legal counsel for American Crystal Sugar Company. I know that we have limited time today, so I'll get straight to addressing what I think are two key regulatory points concerning this bill. And the first one is that the bill is consistent with the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act. We know this for two reasons. First, the bill simply provides for, as Doug mentioned, what is already allowed by the MPCA itself in the Lake Superior Basin, what is recommended by EPA as an appropriate approach to whole effluent toxicity, and what is allowed in EPA-approved MPDS permit programs in other states, including nearby states of Wisconsin and Missouri. And but furthermore, to the extent there are any concerns about whether the bill's interim provisions, for example, concerning anti-backsliding violate the act, the bill is very clear that these provisions only apply to the extent allowed under the Federal Clean Water Act. So there should be no conflicts with federal law. The other second point I'd just like to quickly address is that this bill is not only necessary to address the double standard that Doug referred to, but it would also limit MPCA from doing what is so frustrating for regulated parties like American Crystal Sugar, which is regulating by policy instead of by duly promulgated rules. In this case, any discharger in Minnesota that wants can obtain a mixing zone if it meets strict technical specifications set forth in MPCA rules. These are statewide rules, but they don't specifically address whole effluent toxicity. So by contrast, in the Lake Superior Basin, the MPCA does have additional mixing zone rules for discharges located in the basin, and they do address whole effluent toxicity. And as noted, these rules allow a discharger the option of meeting wet requirements through the use of a very limited and MPCA-approved mixing zone designed to protect aquatic life. Discharges outside the Lake Superior Basin, such as for American Crystal Sugar in this case, MPCA regulates that pursuant to a 20-year-old MPCA policy document that does not allow this limited wet mixing zone. So this creates a double standard and a competitive disadvantage for dischargers outside of the basin. So this bill is designed to address this double standard by making the longstanding Lake Superior Basin rules that were adopted after proper notice and comment rulemaking, make those applicable statewide. And as importantly, the bill directs MPCA to stop regulating by this 20-year-old policy document and adopt rules. And the document itself, as I've got on the screen here, indicates that it was intended to be MPCA's temporary guidance document in these matters until such time as rules are finalized. So the bill directs MPCA to undertake this rulemaking that it promised to do 20 years ago. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have Greta Goff here, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Greta Gothier. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today and for the opportunity to testify on House File 1014. Whole effluent toxicity is a tool from the Federal Clean Water Act that the US EPA allows states to use to ensure that discharge from permitted facilities does not harm fish, bugs, and other aquatic life in surface waters. Whole effluent toxicity is a measure of toxicity of the discharge water, and we in Minnesota make that measurement at the end of the pipe that goes out of the facility, the point where the facility's wastewater is discharged into rivers, lakes, or streams. The bill before you would change that point of measurement to the edge of a mixing zone downstream instead of at the end of the pipe. And Mr. Chairman, if I could please share my screen for a moment to show you a couple of quick slides that will explain faster than I can talk what this is about.
Go ahead.
Okay. There. So, Mr. Chairman, what you're seeing here is a slide that shows the current situation that we regulate at, and the permit is set and measured at the end of the pipe. Here, the river is flowing from right to left. There is no acute mixing zone, no areas of acute toxicity, and we measure it at one TUA, or toxicity unit. Toxicity unit is a level at which 50% of the aquatic life in the stream in this area would survive. Under the bill, it establishes something called the acute wet mixing zone, and it's a larger zone, as you can see, and we're measuring now at the end of the zone here what the toxicity is, and capping it at 0.3. In order for that to be 0.3, it means that this number back here could be as high as 3 toxic units, and at 1, and you can see the different areas here. In the area 1, you have 50% survival. In area, when you get to 3 toxic units down here at the very output, you only have 33.3% of the species in the water surviving. So, Mr. Chairman, we oppose this bill. I'm going to try to stop sharing my screen. There we go. We oppose this bill for 4 main reasons. First of all, there are implications beyond this one permittee. There are 47 permittees statewide that have whole effluent toxicity conditions in their water discharge permits from MPCA. Under this bill, each of those facilities could have up to a 3-fold increase in the toxicity levels of the effluent as it comes out of their discharge pipe and into the receiving water. Second, this bill does conflict with the Federal Clean Water Act. The language on line 2.12 and 2.13 clearly states that they are rescinding the application of anti-backsliding provisions, and that is a direct contradiction to the Federal Clean Water Act regulations. Third, the bill has significant costs for the agency that are not funded. For one thing, we would have to do a rulemaking to change our rules. And also, if this bill was enacted, then we would have to redo all of those 46 other permits. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I'll note that the Minnesota and the other Great Lakes states were and are required by EPA to implement specific water quality standards in the Great Lakes Basin. So when EPA came to the states and the provinces and told us we needed to do this, Minnesota already had our whole effluent toxicity standard. And then the EPA told us to cooperate and compromise to get to an agreement with all the other states in the Great Lakes and provinces. And so we did that. And so the Great Lakes standards have been approved by the EPA, but they're different than the rest of the standards in the states. EPA did require the Great Lakes states to agree, and so those numbers represent that compromise. Meanwhile, the standard we had before that and still have for the rest of Minnesota outside the Great Lakes Basin goes the same for all these industries, and it was designed to be Minnesota-specific and to protect our waters in Minnesota. In summary, Mr. Chair, this bill represents to us a step backwards on water quality. With all due respect, we recognize some of the issues that industries have right now with COVID and everything, but right now, 40% of Minnesota's surface waters are impaired. More and more Minnesotans are asking us to make the water cleaner. And unfortunately, this bill does not go in that direction. That's the end of my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I do have agency experts with me today in case there are questions. Thank you.
I would note Representative Marquardt is here. Maybe if he would like to say a few words and then we'll go to questions.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Sorry for my tardiness. I was chairing the tax committee on a bill. I just could not leave early, but we did finish up. So thank you for adjusting things. So I'm not going to repeat what I'm sure was said by testifiers and others, but you know, basically this comes down to really fairness and what a lot of businesses, especially in my area, large businesses, feel is an unfair competitive disadvantage, where you've got the Lake Superior Basin with various, you know, rules allowing them to measure wet at the end of the mixing zone, where in other areas of the state, they have to measure this right at the end of the pipe. And, you know, American Crystal Sugar Company is a huge economic driver in the Red River Valley in northwest Minnesota. And this is going to increase tens of millions of dollars of cost with this inconsistency. And so what the bill basically says is let's apply the same rule as the Lake Superior Basin, which allows them to measure the effluent out at the end of the mixing zone. And until that time, basically allow, if you're less than the 0.3, I think, toxic units, you know, at the end of the mixing zone, that would be allowed until a rule comes forward. So all of you know the technical stuff much more than me. I see it as let's kind of all get on the same page, because there's this real perception, and it's, I guess, reality of it, is that various areas of the state are treating how businesses and entities have to discharge into streams and rivers and so forth differently, and we just need to have more consistency with that. So again, thanks for adjusting, and we'll answer any questions.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who this question, maybe this is a better question for the MPCA, but I'm just wondering, so clearly this affects the folks who are here testifying their company, but I'm wondering if there's a map or something or information on sort of what other companies or industries are these companies that have these permits that would be affected in, and where are they located, primarily in certain parts of the state, or are they kind of all over the state? So I don't know if that's a question that can be answered right now, but that's something I'm wondering about.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, at the request of a stakeholder, we did a map up for those sites, and I also have the list. And I think my colleague, Katrina Kessler, is going to try to put it in the chat right now, or bring it up. There it is. So, Katrina, maybe you want to talk about the map.
Ms. Kessler, introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, yeah, I'm Katrina Kessler. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As Ms. Gauthier noted, we had received a question about where else these facilities are, similar question that Representative Welswick just answered asked, and you can see that there are facilities across the state. Ms. Gauthier mentioned 46 others. So we have different types of industries represented, as well as municipal wastewater treatment plants.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the purple lines, those are class one water. So those are waterways that are maintained for the use of drinking water.
Representative Woslick.
That's all the questions I had. Thank you.
Members, are there any other questions? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to know obviously based on where this plant's located, what does the other side of that water basin look like as to their standards? And also, as I would understand it, we're in the upstream end. The rest of it deals with Canada. So is there, does MPCA or maybe the bill author have a comparison of how this situation is being treated in Minnesota versus North Dakota or points north in the country of Canada? What is there a big difference?
Representative Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewitt brings up a great question because, right, we have North Dakota right next to us. So unless we're kind of on the same page, it somewhat dilutes what we're trying to do. But more specifically, I think maybe the testifiers could say how they're controlled on the North Dakota side, because they also have plants on the North Dakota side in the red too. So
anyone of the Crystal Sugar?
Sure, Mr. Chair, I can answer that. This is Doug.
Mr. Emerson, go ahead.
Yeah, we are. We do have two factories on the North Dakota side. They have, one of them does actually have a river diffuser that it uses to discharge its water into the, I believe it's the Goose Lake River. But all the discharges from all five of our factories in the Red River Valley, to include Crookston and East Grand Forks and Moorhead, which are all in Minnesota, eventually enter into the Red Lake, Red River, and meander up into Canada.
Representative Lewis.
I was curious about, is there a difference in how the North, for example, North Dakota environmental standards treat the plants over there, and also any similar industries north of the border? In other words, it would look like we got a Minnesota approach, we got probably a North Dakota approach and a Canadian approach, and I think that's why we ended up with a circumstance with the Great Lakes approach, was because we were dealing with more than one state and, in fact, another country. So it would seem like we've got a very similar situation here with the Red River watershed.
Representative Marquardt.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, yeah, I mean, I think there are differences. I've worked with the city of Moorhead when they've had to go through with their wastewater discharge and so forth. And North Dakota standards are different. And that's part of the problem here, is we're having entities pay tens of millions of dollars to upgrade, when downstream, as the Red River heads towards Canada, it may not be making a lot of difference. So that's part of the concerns we have.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that as long as we can meet the appropriate environmental standards, we shouldn't be putting our industries at a competitive disadvantage by forcing them to spend more than people literally eyeball to eyeball with, or even within the same company. We're just asking industries to move out of the state if we treat them that way. Thank you.
Representative Backer, and then we'll go to closing comments from Representative Marquardt. Representative Backer.
This is just a comment. My district is just south of Representative Chair Marquardt, and I agree with him on this one. We have what we're doing is, we got the state that's picking winners and losers. And then we also have a state that says, hey, if you're in another state, we want industry in other states instead of our states. And quite frankly, in West Central Minnesota, the district I represent starts at Red River Valley. And this is important. This is just common sense. Everybody should be treated the same. The map really told us the whole story. And so I do appreciate your efforts there, Chair Marquardt. Thank you. And I support this.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt. American Crystal Sugar Company is in my community, and I actually went and did the best tour that I could. It was really fascinating to me, but I was trying to find my notes. And so Mr. Emerson, you might have mentioned it in yours, but we talked about the graph that PCA showed us said that out of the end of the pipe is 5 TCUs, and then there's this area that goes further than that in the dissolvent area. But I feel like when I came and talked with you all, your end of pipe TCU is much lower than that because of the work that you've invested to move towards better clean water discharge. Is that right? Do you have that updated TCU number at end of pipe right now?
Mr. Emerson.
Yes, thank you. I hate to say it, but the graph that the agency just showed, the measurement is employed at the end of pipe, but it's actually a laboratory test. So the lab test does not necessarily imply that that's the toxicity character of our actual discharge when it's actually being physically discharged from the end of the pipe.
Representative Keeley.
No more questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Again, thanks for hearing this bill. And American Crystal Sugar Company is, you know, just one company that's here today. But these are all good business partners. They play a huge role in our communities, not only economically, but what they do for the quality of life. And when there's inconsistency in state rules and laws and so forth, that, you know, one area of the state's being treated differently than another, and it results in millions of dollars of increased costs, not to the business, but also back to consumers and so forth, that's a concern. And I've met with MPCA folks and really appreciated that. And everyone wants clean waterways. I mean, everyone wants to do that. And it's just, how can we do that in a fair way and make sure that we're doing things that are practical, to going to protect waters, but yet not incur costs that may not be necessary. So again, thank you very much. Appreciate hearing the bill today on 1014.
Representative Wislock, to renew your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
House File 1014 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Bill is laid over. Members, just a little roadmap ahead. I hope that everyone has a great break coming up and enjoys a little bit of time off. We will be trying to work on a bill to present shortly after we come back. We expect that week that we come back from break will be a very busy week, where we will be presenting a bill, a budget bill for this committee that then will be available for amendment and then would be passed out hopefully at the end of that week or shortly after. We are unclear on that as of yet. We also will be hearing the cannabis bill sometime in the week after we return from break. I think we've had a good almost 3 months of committee work here. I think we've heard over 60 bills. I want to thank all the members of the committee for their work and debate. It's been challenging in COVID and working in Zoomlandia here to try to get things done, but I appreciate everybody's patience and effort. We have more work to do. Enjoy seeing you after the break. And with that, we are adjourned.